Dr. Orth, thank you for your patience. Welcome. Do you need an attorney, sir?
No, I don't. Okay, where's the... You guys need to get a real attorney to buzz in the lower court.
I'm convinced I'm never going to get an attorney.
Oh, no. Just messing with you, Ted.
That's more stretching.
Sure.
What?
Have you ever seen me do three slides? Where are we here? I am looking for my little. Okay, thanks very much. If you would care to turn the lights down a little bit, you might be able to see the slides just a little bit better. And I'll be watching to make sure that no one falls asleep. Great, thanks. Anyway, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here with my annual presentation on SAV issues. This is the agenda that I have for today, where the numbers that I want to take in front of you. I'm going to start off with, again, just some background work so that you know why I'm here and where we're going with these issues related to underwater grasses. So, again, why SAV? Why are we so concerned? Again, this is an underwater plant, very sensitive to water quality there, the canary in the cage, and they're being used as a key indicator of water quality and the ability to assess the effectiveness of the cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay. In addition, and I haven't offered this slide to you, again, to highlight that these underwater grasses are important nurseries and an important habitat for a lot of organisms that we have in the Chesapeake Bay. I want to highlight the fact that you hear a lot about blue crabs. A lot of the work that we've done at VIMS and currently are doing highlight just how important these seagrass beds are to blue crabs, in particular the juveniles, and some data. This is old stuff, but it basically says that while there's a lot of underwater habitat that's unvegetated, when you look at the crabs per square meter on grass, there are many more crabs per square meter in the grass than under unvegetated areas. Again, you'll hear this over and over. This is probably the primo habitat for juvenile blue crabs in the lower bay, in particular because if you know about the life cycle, the young recruit into the bay and settle in these grass beds and grow and then migrate to other habitats. The fact is that there are standards, water quality standards, not just in Virginia, but also in Maryland. And last year I didn't highlight this, but the fact that Maryland also has water quality standards, basically SAV acreage, the numbers that we report to you and other agencies, they're now included and have been included in the attainment of Chesapeake Bay water quality standards. The bottom line is in all of this, as I've said over and over, every acre counts, and actually a slide that I'm going to show is that actually every blade counts in the Chesapeake Bay as we try to improve the quality of the bay and improve the quantity and quality of SAV. This is a new slide that I put in because I've got a young man working for me now that has looked at data. The reason why I wanted to put the slide up for two reasons. This is a project of projects that were supported by the Virginia Recreational Fishing License Board. You guys approved it. We put plants in some very interesting patterns of checkerboard squares, and we did this over several years. Some of the sites were right here in our backyard in the James River. And we sampled the animals, little animals that occur in these beds that are essentially the seagrasses are providing habitat. The bottom line is no matter how small or how big, the numbers of animals in each of these plots is the same, no difference. The bottom line is the more grass, the more animals. And that's important because, again, as a nursery and as a habitat, we want as much grass as we can because of the fact this is what we're aiming for and important for this. So very quickly, the message is more grass, more animals. So let's move on to the first major item that I give to you every year is what's the bay-wide SAV status. As I've told you before, VIMS has the responsibility of mapping SAV in all parts of the bay, including all its tributaries, using aerial imagery. These flights are very sensitive in the sense that we have to be careful of the wind, cloud cover, low tide, turbidity, and sun angle to make sure that we have good imagery. We report all these data in these different segments to each of these agencies, including you and DEQ and to Maryland. Each one of these segments, and this is Chesapeake Bay segments, has an SAV restoration target. And that's what we report our data on these targets. This is a new type of imagery that we're using. In the past, we've used regular aerial photography. The contractor that we use has moved to digital imagery, so this is what we now see. This is an area at the mouth of the York River. The red outlines the entire bed. You can see this is grass. These are the Guinea Marsh Islands at the mouth of the York River. And what you can see, although we can, all these little black dots throughout here are expanding grass beds. So this is the important component, is that we want to know just what's happening with these grasses, especially where either they're expanding. But this area is really very dense, very solid, 100% cover eelgrass. And this is how we, again, map these grass beds from these digital images. So let's move on to the data. Here is the 2014. Now, I don't have 2015 because we're working on that now, so this is always retrospective to what's happening in the recent past. And as you can see from the 2014, bay-wide, this is the entire bay. These are where all the grass beds occur in the Chesapeake Bay. In 2014, we recorded something like 75,000 acres, which was an increase of almost 15,000 acres from the previous year. I mean, that's an impressive increase. And, you know, one asks, how can these beds increase by 15,000 acres? Well, when you take the whole bay and you're watching all these different segments, and the fact that these beds recover slowly, but in some cases recover very rapidly in some areas, we sometimes see swings of 15,000 acres, both plus and minus. And plus, as you can see here, we had a low point in 2012, and the bay-wide SAV coverage has increased from less than 50,000 to now 75,000 acres. So in these three-year time period, we're gaining a lot of SAV in the bay. However, the goal for the bay is still at 185,000 acres based on historical coverage. So for the 2014 total, we're only at 41% of that restoration goal. When we look at the different segments of the bay, so again, because the bay has different species, depending on where you are, you know, you hear about a hydrilla in the freshwater area, there's widgeon grass, the mid part, and eelgrass in the lower bay. So, you know, we present these data based on the different salinity zones, because each of the species are tolerant to certain types of salt. So in the tidal fresh, we have freshwater species like wild celery and hydrilla and milfoil and things like that. And as we move through the bay down to the lower bay zone, where most of us are familiar with, this zone is has just two species, eelgrass and widgeon grass. So as you can see, if you look at the 2014 data, we had a little bit of increase in 2014, but certainly far less than what we had in the earlier period. The area where we had the greatest increase is what's called the mesohaline, this light color here, which occupies the biggest portion of the bay. And what's happening here is that we have actually just almost one single species, widgeon grass, now occupying it, which widgeon grass is one of these dynamic species that comes and goes. But for the reasons we're still trying to comprehend, the last few years, widgeon grass has been expanding rapidly throughout the bay. The area that we're most concerned about here is the lower bay zone in Virginia, the polyhaline. And while we saw a modest increase, it is not anything compared to what we had back in the 90s. I put these red arrows saying hot. These are the 2 years that we had extremely hot conditions that had a remarkable effect on eelgrass in the bay. And as you can see, here is a hot year followed by a very low cycle of eelgrass and widgeon grass. It increased through 2010. 2010 was another hot year, and we saw another downturn. The beds are recovering, and I can guarantee you when we map to 2015, we'll have more. But 2015 was also a hot summer, so we're not sure what we'll see in 2016. But again, the picture for 14 and probably going into 15 is good news for the bay and for Bay SAV. Now, I want to focus on one segment, the Mobjack Bay. I always show you this. Again, this is an area that has quite a bit of grass. It's one of the hot spots for fishing for speckled trout. And again, here are the trends for that and what we saw in 14, not much of an increase. And again, this is an area that's dominated by two species. And again, here are these heat events in 05 and 10, and then the decline following that, because eelgrass, which is the one that's suffering most from this heat, is the one that is most affected and which affects the change that we see in these two hot years. Now, I'm bringing this up because, you know, you hear a lot about how climate's changing, how the bay is warming up. I'm bringing this up because we are asking a very important question. You know, if the bay is warming, are we going to see a change in the two species that we have? Because they tolerate very different temperatures. Eelgrass likes it cool. Widgeon grass likes it hot. So what we've done during these following heat events, we've gone out and to different places in the bay, all these little dots, we've essentially picked 25 spots in the bay, 21 here in the lower western shore, two over here on the eastern shore, and two up here on the northern neck, where what we've done, instead of having these high-level aerial photographs, we set up what's called a transect. And we run transect from the shoreline to offshore, and every 10 meters, we stick our face in the water, and we measure the abundance of how much grass is there, and of the grass that's there, what amount is of the two species. And these transects sometimes can be as short as 200. The transects that some of we have off the coast and flats, you know, go up to 1,800 meters. We're incredibly accurate, so we go back to almost the exact same square meter every single year. We use a Garmin GPS, and those observations are incredibly accurate. From 2008 through 2015, we've made over 10,000 individual observations. So again, it's a diver sticking their head in the water saying, there's grass, there's this much grass, and it's made of these two species. So what are we seeing? And I'm not going to show you all 25. I'm going to show you three representative transects to let you know that the story is not quite as simple as some people might want to make it out to be. So here's Back River. Here's a transect that we started in 2008, 2 years after the dieback. You're going to see these three slides that will have the same color. Eelgrass is going to be in the green or light blue, and widgeongrass is in the red. So here in 2008 when we started, we had lots of eelgrass throughout the transect. And through that time period, we've lost eelgrass along this transect. So now it's at the outer edge of this. And this is kind of along the shoal. You've got deep, shoal, deep. And where we're finding the eelgrass surviving is in the deep area, where in this very shallow area, eelgrass now occupies it almost 100% of the cover. And these figures go from 0 to 100%. And these are the years, every single year, to the exact same spot. And so, again, a change from eelgrass to widgeongrass, primarily in the shallowest locations of this transect. So that's one. Let's go to another one. And this is kind of an interesting one. This is Browns Bay. We actually have data to go back to 1978, but there's a hiatus from 78 to 94. But what you'll notice is this is 78. This is like 6 years after Tropical Storm Magnus that basically changed the face of the bay. And we started doing these transects, but there was a hiatus in which we basically went primarily to aerial photographs. But you can see in 94, lots of eelgrass. And let's follow that. So eelgrass. And as you move down here, again, widgeongrass in the shallowest areas, still persistent, but even changing to where now, in the last few years, almost no eelgrass and almost no widgeongrass. So here's another transect, very different from that first one. And then the third one is kind of interesting. This is Hungers Creek, the mouth of Hungers Creek on the eastern shore bayside. Very different. So here's 1978, again, 6 years after Agnes. A lot of the eelgrass is in the offshore area is gone. But in 2008, when we restarted this transect, look at all the eelgrass across that transect and persisting all the way through 2015. So even with some of these heat events, eelgrass has persisted in this and actually has increased coverage along this entire transect. So in looking at all these 25 transects, the story is just not as simple as the bay's warming up and it's going to all change the widgeongrass. So it depends on the particular location. So this is an important component of our program is we need to understand what's happening with these two species, and we'll continue this every year and trying to understand, well, how is the bay changing as the bay warms up? And how is that going to influence, you know, the types of animals that colonize these areas? I just want to highlight, I said this last year, we do a lot of water quality work. I'm going to say this is it because there's a very enormous data set that not just PHMS but DEQ and other people collect, and there's a lot of different sensors. Everyone is concerned about what's happening with water quality. So there's a lot of data. You could have a whole presentation on this alone, and I'll leave that to someone else to tell you what's happening with the water quality. But just be assured that people are watching. They are putting an awful lot of effort into local communities to improve land use, stormwater regulations. If you're a local politician like I am, we hear it all the time. Stormwater regulations are controversial but important in improving the quality of the water for the resources that we're talking about here. And again, I haven't shown this slide in a while. This is a slide that we did that we need to update. But in terms of clarity, the water is not getting cleaner. It's getting less clear. So you can see a downtrend for the Chesapeake Bay and a few segments. And this is something that concerns all of us in the Bay program. Why is the Bay, with all the effort that we're putting to trying to improve the Bay, the water actually is getting less clear? And it's a $64,000 question that a lot of people are going to be looking at a lot of data trying to figure why is this happening, because it does affect the grasses because they require the light. So again, this is for your information. You'll be hearing about this every year from me, probably in between. I just want to make you aware that in the next year there's going to be a huge effort to figure out what is going on with the clarity in the Chesapeake Bay. Let's move on quickly to the other areas. Chesapeake Bay sanctuary, again, a Chincoteague sanctuary. Yeah, these were the scars that came from dredging from for clams. VMRC developed a sanctuary in Chincoteague in which we monitor the scars. Here are the data, you know, from the time we started to where we are now. Thankfully, in 2014, there were no circular scars. I want to thank your officers out there for watching carefully. We had some in 2012, but we watched those scars. They've recovered. I will say that, you know, with the gas prices really cheap, I notified Mr. O'Reilly to please be careful, because with gas prices cheap, you know, people might have a tendency to go out because it's not going to cost that much to get clams. But anyway, for 14, we saw no scarring in Chincoteague Bay. Great news. Propeller scarring, again, this is something that I report to you every year that you provide funding, which I'll be asking for that continuation at the end. Again, these are the scars that are caused by the hall stainers, and we noticed and updated you every year on this. We look at two very specific locations, Browns Bay, one of the areas that we have the transects that I told you about, and the Pocosin area. This is where a lot of the hall staining occurs in areas that are vegetated. This is what we saw that garnered the interest that made us start this project. These are the data, again, that I show you every year, and this is the time period that brought us to the commission to effect the change and to let the people know that grass beds are important, that you don't want to scar. So every one of these points represents how many meters of scarring we saw. Now, obviously, in this time period in the 90s, a lot. But we also found that these scars recover very quickly. So here's this time period after we made presentations. And, you know, again, no new rules or regulations other than to watch how they haul stain, which was great. So Brown, Pocosin Flats, not a lot. And I expanded that a little bit here. Again, you can see there's just not a lot out there. So despite a lot of the haul stainers out there, because we know they're out there, we're not seeing the extensive scarring that occurred earlier. So they are being very careful in terms of when and how they haul. Browns Bay, again, lots in that time period. But, again, we follow it every year. And you may say, why do we do this every year? Well, you know, I think being the eye in the sky, people know that we're doing this, and they know that I'm going to be looking at this, and they know that I come here every year. And I'd like to think that a little bit of deterrent is something that, you know, prevents extensive scarring from occurring again. And, again, here's the expanded stuff. Just not a lot. I mean, we look at it carefully, but, again, we're not seeing the extensive scarring that occurred. So I think this kind of watching, and people know that we're doing this, and they know that we're being fair, and we work with them to let them know what's going on. So I think it's a good compromise, and I'm hoping that you'll continue this program for another year. Aquaculture issues. All I can say is that, you know, again, there's a lot of conflicts, user conflicts. I heard about that earlier when I came in. Aquaculture and oyster. I know that your staff is getting application after application for not just clam aquaculture, but oyster aquaculture. I think we have a very good relationship. The VIM staff, myself, working with your staff, when we get applications, or they get applications, they try to come to us to get our input. We're not the regulators, we're the advisors, but I think that we have that good relationship. If there's any way of compromise, we try to work with them. And just to let you know, there are actually two laws. This is Virginia that says, you know, this is what you guys approved in 98. But I also wanted to highlight that Maryland has the same thing, and I wanted to bring this because it shows that actually within the Chesapeake Bay, you know, VIMS is highlighted in their code that they require our survey data. So by us monitoring, they're also looking very carefully at the monitoring data that we have for the Bay, and they use this in their aquaculture enterprise zones. As there's a lot of, I mean, they're getting as many permits as your staff in terms of places to do aquaculture. It's a hot item, and we see lots of it throughout the Bay. So I just want to say that a lot of work goes on behind the scenes between VIMS and your staff, and I think that by not reporting any problems, it says that we're working out those problems behind the scenes that you don't have to hear. One less thing for you all on your agenda. Okay, the last one, and this is one that I just am tickled pink about, that I love talking about with you all, is our work on the seaside with the restoration of the seaside bays. Told you about this. You know, our goal has been the reestablishment of eelgrass once we knew that eelgrass could be supported there, and the return of these ecosystem services, the habitat, the nursery, and in particular the bay scallop, the commercial fishery that was once there that disappeared, and the effort that we have underway. So let's step back. Here's what we see right now. Here's the map for 2015. Now, we didn't have any data because of the inability to get good aerial imagery. So the last time we had a good full survey was 2012, when we had a little less than 5,000. Well, in those 2 years, those eelgrass beds continued to expand. So now we're almost at 6,500 acres of eelgrass in these coastal bays. So over this time period, we have seeded almost 500 acres with about 71 million seeds. And the difference between this blue line and this line is what nature does. You know, we don't have any control. But once we get these plants in, they reproduce seeds on their own and spread. So the success story really continues, and we're very proud to be a part of a successful story rather than reporting to you that things in the bay are going downhill. So it's fun to kind of end on a very positive note. Now, I bring this up because last year you all had some interesting discussion about set-aside areas. And there was quite a debate, and I appreciated your support for the fact that you let us have two areas, Area 1 and Area 2. And I remember Mr. Erskine said, well, you know, why should we do 3 and 4? Because eelgrass is going to occur. Well, you know, here are the data for 2015. Now, this is a slide I showed you last year. It's a busy slide. It shows you the public grounds. It shows you the private grounds in this hatching. It shows the beds over time as they've expanded from this dark green in South Bay, where we started the work in 2001. All the colors show these beds expanding. This nice color here is what we saw in 13 in South Bay. And then the red is how this bed has expanded in 2015. So here are these two areas you didn't give us. And as Mr. Erskine rightly said, hey, they're going to go in there anyway. I believe you were the one that brought that up. And yeah, this, as we mapped, here's those two set-asides, and we're starting to get the encouragement of grass. And I can tell you that, you know, from our ground surveys, when we put our face in the bottom, you know, these beds are expanding even in these areas. So I would expect that in 16, you know, we're going to see. And you know, from the point of view of where we're trying to go with the scallop, which I'll go into shortly, you know, this is really important because we need this habitat for those bay scallops. This is the substrate, the eelgrass, that is important for the settlement of these bay scallops. And, you know, I did bring this up last year. We have noted some of the scarring in one of the private leases. We've noted that, and because it's a private lease, we have no control, but we're hoping that maybe we can talk to the person and minimize that. It's not a lot, but we have noted that some of the scars are outside, and we've noted your officers to make note of that so that, you know, whatever happens inside the leased area. Okay, let's move on to the next exciting part, our bay scallop update. You know, beginning in 2009 with, you know, Mark Lukenbach and his staff, we initiated a bay scallop restoration effort, and this entailed primarily putting scallops in cages and letting them spawn. Scallops placed in one cage in one area. Hopefully those scallops would spread throughout the bay. Our assessment initially took into account small guys, where we used a suction sampler, and adults, where we put divers and put our face in the water. In 2015, we shifted that technique to just looking at the adults because we found that this technique, you'd have to collect far more samples than any human could look at to get a good number. So we shifted our focus in 2015 to looking primarily at adults and using primarily divers, snorkelers. So our 2015, this was a pretty interesting assessment because here's the South Bay area that we just showed you pictures of, but here's Cobb Bay. And this is spider crab, and Hog Island's up here. But we divided the really dense grass beds in three of these sections into four segments per location. And each one of these, we had 40 sites, and in these sites, we had 20. Each site had 50 square meters of seagrass checked by a diver. So at the end of a one-week period, we covered 16,000 square meters. That is, individually had hand going over bottom looking for scallops. That literally has 4 acres that our divers looked for bay scallops. It was pretty intensive. This is how it worked. We had 4 boats. We had 5 to 6 divers per boat. The deal was you get in the water, you know, you have quadra, you lay it down, you look for a scallop, you record the data, and when you find a scallop, you're really happy. because at first they weren't a lot. And as it got through the years, we found more and more. And I can tell you when, you can tell when someone finds a scallop because they're yelling and screaming in the water. So we try to have individual, unique sounds for each person so we know who gets the scallops. But it's an exciting thing, and the fact, here are the data. Now, these are 12, 13, and 14 for South Bay. These are the three bays. Now, this is the South Bay. So we're looking at, you know, again, about the same numbers of bay scallops in South. But the fact is, here's Cobb, and here's the other part. We're now finding scallops throughout the system. So the bottom line is that while all the scallop cages are in one spot, they're spreading throughout these different bays. And we also know that some of the aquaculture people are also reporting scallops inside the nets. So these scallops are really spreading. And, you know, as I've said before, this is a long-term effort. We're going to continue. We're trying to ramp up. You know, last year we purchased some scallops from a hatchery to just broadcast at a size, at a bigger size. You know, we're doing whatever we can to see if we can be successful in bringing back the bay scallop. And so this is the continuing story that every year I'll be talking about with you. So it's a lot of fun. But, you know, there's always these little things that happen that you don't anticipate. So this year was kind of interesting. So you all know about 20,000 leagues under the sea, the big octopus that comes up and eats all this stuff. Well, we had our version this year of 20,000 leagues. I mean, if anybody told me there were octopus in this region, I would have said, no way. Well, when Mark's crew went out and they looked at one of the scallop cages, here is this huge octopus. And unfortunately, you know what octopus like? They like bivalves. And that one cage didn't have a single bay scallop left. So this is something now, whether we're going to see more of them, you think, how does an octopus get from somewhere into the middle of this grass bed and finds a cage and gets inside the cage when the cage is clamped shut? I don't know. I mean, it's just like mind-boggling. But anyway, we have our own little 20,000 leagues guy here. And this is a pretty big scallop guy. I said, why don't you guys keep him for sushi? Anyway, we'll see what happens. But that was a surprise. Now, the other thing is, there's a word called tropicalization. Have any of you heard this word tropicalization in your... Okay, does anybody have an idea what that actually means? Question of the day. I know, finish up. Okay, I'm getting it. I can't help it. I only have one chance. Okay, so what tropicalization? It's all about the movement of tropical species that we have south of us to more northern latitudes as the oceans warm. You've heard me talk about the bay warming up. Well, we have this little guy called the pinfish. Well, you know, we've seen pinfish before in our trawls. The last few years, we are seeing more and more to where they are becoming the dominant fish. Now, in more southern latitudes, they're everywhere, and they chomp on some of the animals. How this animal is going to influence what happens in our areas, we don't know. How it might influence the bay scallops, we don't know. There are bay scallops in areas where there are pinfish in the Gulf, but this animal is voracious. It eats lots of little animals, and it is incredibly abundant. I just want to kind of point out, because this is the new word of the day for you guys. You can talk it, take to go home tonight, talk to your spouses, whatever. You just heard a word that sounds really weird, and it's a typical science word. But it's how animals are moving now as the bay warms up, the oceans warm up. We may see more of these creepy characters and are going to challenge us on how we fix up the bay. So in summary, again, really quickly, the water quality, again, remains the major driver for SAB distribution abundance. But, you know, for some of our species, especially in the lower bay eelgrass, the water temperatures are going to be a problem and are emerging, are a concern. The chincoteague, again, new scarring. Thank you, officers, for keeping track. We got to keep on monitoring the propeller scarring, low levels, but we got to keep on monitoring, which is why, you know, I need your support for that for another year. Aquaculture, I said, hey, you don't hear of many problems because we work with your staff and keep it low so you don't have to deal with lots of issues that you've had like today. And the coastal base, our eelgrass is still expanding. The bay scallop work shows promise, and you know, next year hopefully we'll have even more news, unless we have more octopus. And so our actions today, I'm going to need your support for the proposal that we have for funding, and I need your support for the SAB annual monitoring. We're going in for a six-year cycle. There's always a problem with money, and you know, we're trying to see how we can get support for this work because the annual data are really important in figuring out, or one of those resources that tell us how the bay is doing. So with that, that's a lot, and I appreciate your support. If I've gone too fast, which I usually do when I throw out a lot of stuff, if you like individual presentations, I'd be happy to meet with you at any time. If you have any questions, I know it's late, and I was pretty drained after those.
You need
to increase. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer it. I know it's late. I appreciate your hanging in with me. And again, if you'd like any information, I'd be more than happy to talk to you on the phone or come up and talk to you some more about it. So
that's always interesting. Always fascinating. Thank you, Dr. Orth.
Something different.
Yeah. Questions to the commission? Mr. Tankard.
What about waterfowl? Are you starting to see them?
Oh, gosh. Over on the seaside, there are so many brant. It's unbelievable. When we go out there in March, there are brant everywhere. I mean, that's one of the species that disappeared because brant like eelgrass. I mean, they are just unbelievable. I don't know who's keeping track of it, but there are brant. And I'm not surprised that sooner or later we may see permits or people just hunting out there. But there are a lot of brant, and we know they're feeding on grass.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's pretty impressive. Yeah. It's exciting to go out there. It's such a unique area. And actually, if any of you ever want to come out, you know, we're out there a lot, and you've got my address and phone number. If you ever want to come out with us, we're out there a lot, so we'd be happy to have you come out.
Thank you.
Mr. Ballard.
We heard a case, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, someone wanted a lease somewhere on the bay side of the Eastern Shore, and I think it had been recommended by VIMS that there was grass on the lease. And he was trying to plead the case that it was there for a month or two during the summer and then would disappear. Is that indicative of eelgrass or widgeongrass? And can you talk about that a little bit?
Widgeongrass will do that. We've seen vast expanses of widgeongrass in places in 1 year and then gone the next. We've seen widgeongrass populations abundant in midsummer, then it gets really hot, and sometimes they will go. But again, that's the important thing of monitoring every year so that we know what's happening. So that when we have cases like that, we can be fair in our response to VMRC that they ask us for that advice. I will say that when they give us information, we have historical records, and they have two, but we try to figure out how we can place aquaculture permits in areas that don't interfere with grass. Because sometimes these things occur in areas that are sandy or not sandy, and so you might have a patchwork nature. By having an understanding of what happens at a particular site, we can say, okay, you know, this part of that area doesn't have grass all the time. It's kind of hard to map every single blade. So we put polygons around it and say, okay, you know, hey, you can use a portion of the area because it doesn't have grass. So that's how we try to work with the staff and coming up with solutions. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it does. But we do our best to provide the best advice to your staff to make the best decision and hopefully keep those cases from coming to you guys.
Any other questions from the commission? I have one. You need money?
Well, yeah. Of course. We don't. You know, it's always needs money.
It was kind of a rhetorical question.
No, that's right. You know us by now.
Chief?
So the commission traditionally votes on the funding. Last year it was $22,000, $11,000 from the Marine Fishing Improvement Fund, the commercial fund, $11,000 from the Recreational License Fund.
Same amount this year?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. No inflation. I like that.
Well, there is, but we deal with it.
Mr. Packard?
I'll move that we approve that amount of money for the coming year.
Second.
First by Mr. Tankard, second by Mr. Zedra. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any no's? Chair votes aye as well.
Thank you, sir.
There you go.
Thank you,
Dr. Orth. Appreciate the good work here and very informative presentation.
I enjoy coming before you. And again, I'm always available if you have any questions. Don't hesitate.
It's nice to hear somebody enjoys coming before us. That's right. You got a license?
Well, I do know. One thing I've learned today, I'm not going to hire a lawyer to come before you guys.
Please don't.
You get what you're paid for.